Okay. A little bit about Parsha Shmini, and if we have some time, a little bit about Parsha's Parah. So Parsha Shmini is a very triumphant Parsha. It's a very ratifying Parsha, vindicating Parsha. Because Am Yisrael had sinned terribly, and they felt cast out and cast aside. And Hashem offered them a hope for redemption to build the Mishkan HaEdus. And the primary, not the only, but the primary definition of Mishkan HaEdus is it delivers two messages to the world. One of penitence and one of enduring covenant. A man can sin and a people can sin and still perform tshuva. Remember, we take tshuva for granted. Elul is right around the corner. It's the time for tshuva. Tshuva is not a gimme. Tshuva is not a lamp. Why should a person or people who sin so drastically, why should they be allowed to perform tshuva? So there's a tradition of tshuva. And of course, part of the tradition is reading Sefer Bereishis and witnessing the frailty of man, the failure of Adam and Cain, the failure of Reuven, the failure of Yehuda and their recovery, and the fact that they were Baalei tshuva. But part of it is in Parsha Shmos. After Har Sinai, you think, well, maybe man pre-Har Sinai, maybe we'll carry the margins a little bit because they didn't have exposure to the revealed word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But now it's post-Har Sinai. It's a few weeks later, and they've sinned so terribly, and will HaKadosh Baruch Hu offer them penitence? And even if he will he still offer them covenant? Because Hashem chose us as his people. So maybe Hashem will spare us annihilation, maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu will punish us. Maybe we've lost that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Maybe we're no longer HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chosen people. So the Mishkan HaEdus is a testimony for those two major pillars of human experience, penitence and the enduring covenant with his people, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people, with Am Yisrael, with everyone sitting in this room. And this is the long-awaited-for day. This is the day of Hakamas HaMishkan. And this is the day not just of national vindication, but of personal catharsis. Because Aaron was, anyway, slice it, was complicit in the Chet HaEgel. He could have had well-intentioned strategies. He could have been delaying the holding pattern until Moshe descended. But in the end, blood was his hand. In the end, he bears some guilt. In the end, he feels it. And Rashi delicately traces Aaron's psychological struggle for that day. At the beginning of the parasha, Moshe tells Aaron, "Krav al ha-mizbeach," and Aaron's a little bit embarrassed. And Hashem, and Moshe tells Aaron, "Don't be so embarrassed. Lakach nivcharta." Well, hesitant, because what will people say about him? If not for you, this Mishkan would have been built well ahead of schedule. If not for you, Mishkan wouldn't have been as bittersweet as it is for many of us. Then later in the parasha, Rashi describes that Aaron is not just embarrassed, he's a little bit frustrated because 8 days, endless avoda, endless construction project, and the Shechina still hasn't descended. And of course, Aaron assumes it's his own fault, that maybe I don't deserve the Shechina, maybe I'm thwarting the Shechina. So Moshe begins to daven with him together, let's daven for the Shechina to descend. So this is a very charged day. It's charged for Aaron, it's charged for the Jewish people, a lot of deep emotions, a lot of anticipation. It's hard to imagine a more emotionally fraught day than this day in the Mishkan, in the desert. And everything seems to move along swimmingly until a major tragedy befalls both the Jewish people and Aaron personally. And it's a double tragedy because, of course, Aaron's two children are incinerated. But also because there's a lot of confusion in the wake of this tragedy. Because there were three Korban Chatases brought that day, special Korban Chatases, and they ended up burning one of them rather than eating them. And Moshe is angered by this. And let's see what happens when Moshe becomes angered and how Aaron responds and how his children respond. There's a lot of human emotions on display. When things are calm in life, everyone gets along. It's when things get very tense and there's confrontation and conflict and need for resolution and communication. That's when you see the true measure of people. When pressure sets in, when things get a little bit tense. Under normal conditions, everyone's calm. Everyone's got their space. What happens when you're in a moment of pressure and there's a conflict of interest and there's anger? And those are the moments you shine as a person. Let's see what we can detect in Moshe, in our own three children. So Moshe gets angry. Vayiktzav Moshe v'aseir achataz darosh darash Moshe v'inei saraf vayiktzav al alazar v'al itamar bin Aaron anosarim lemor. Now, of course, this anger could be easily justified because Moshe's panicky. I mean, if two have died, then maybe the other two will die because the two died because of the incorrect processing of the korban. Nadav and Avihu, now Elazar and Isamar burnt the korban chatas inappropriately. So who knows what fate awaits them? So Moshe's feeling a lot of pressure. This isn't just fury and rage or just erupts in anger. But he is deadly worried about these other two children. Look at that word in the pasuk. Al Elazar v'al Itamar b'nei Aharon hanosarim lemor. The last two children. Aaron doesn't have any more children. It's not just a personal tragedy for his brother, but in theory, the entire lineage of Gehuna could terminate on the day it was meant to be coronated. Think about that irony. Nadav and Avihu die, and Elazar and Isamar are going to be punished at some level, maybe not just punished, maybe not killed, but maybe excluded, maybe disqualified, who knows? There's a lot of pressure. How do you handle pressure? Well, Moshe's case, again, we can't really judge Moshe by the metrics and yardsticks that we judge ourselves and we behave. That's not just morally vulgar, it's also intellectually dishonest because it's Moshe Rabbeinu, but at least at his level, it's presented as anger. I promise you Moshe wasn't putting his fist through a wall. I promise you Moshe wasn't cursing. I can guarantee you Moshe wasn't pulling a tirade. At Moshe's level, whatever demeanor he maintained, he lost some of that equilibrium. Wasn't screaming, wasn't shouting, but it wasn't the same equanimity, the same demeanor that Moshe typically maintained. And therefore, the Torah presents it as anger. And Chazal are critical of Moshe. Source number two. Vayitzov ala Elazar ve'al Itamar b'nei Aaron, b'chiven shakas nis'alm halacha mimeno. He forgot the halachas, because Aaron responds, well, this we were owning today. Maybe the special korbanos for today, we should eat even though we're an onain, because these are harat shah. But an onain who has just lost a relative is not allowed to eat kachin. So there's special korbanos today for that kamas amishkan, that's filling in the blanks, as the Gemara says. Aaron's response, special korbanos are so unique that we should eat even though we're an onain. But the normal Rosh Chodesh is also Rosh Chodesh, according to Moshe. The normal Rosh Chodesh korban is just a normal korban. It just happens to be Rosh Chodesh Nisan. We're an onain, we shouldn't eat it, so we burnt it. There's no one else to eat the korban. You can't eat the korban, you have to burn it. Moshe forgot that halacha. Again, he didn't forget the halacha of Bedikas Chametz. He didn't forget Bal Yira Bal Yimatzeh. It was a finger-waving halacha. Well, this and that and that and this, this korban, onain and that one. Not like Moshe forgot ABCs. At least according to Rashi, Gemara is detailed. And an onain can't eat, should eat a unique korban because it's a rasha, a special day. This third korban was a regular routine Rosh Chodesh korban, then onain can't eat, and we're onain, that's what our response. But he still got angry, he still forgot halachos. It's a good chance and a good opportunity to remind ourselves about the toxicity of anger. Remember, it's one of the four or five, you have to look at the four or five terrible toxic midos. It's right up there with jealousy, with greed, with sarcasm, it's anger. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't punish you for a bad mido. I mean, none of these midos are punishable. You don't get punished for anger. You're punished for acting out of anger, hitting, cursing, not allowed to. You don't get punished for jealousy. There's no issue to be jealous. It's a terrible mido. If you act upon jealousy, try to steal something or subvert your friend, you get punished. It's an onesh. Because midos ros don't require an onesh because they are so noxious that they are their own punishment. Hashem doesn't have to punish you for being angry. Being angry is your punishment. You just live your life in a state of rage. And we're going to talk about these traits, try to think about people you may have met, at least from your standpoint. It's important not just to think about mitos in the abstract, both ideally positive mitos, your positive role models when you're a father. That's from the... It's really the best way to learn a mitos. It's very hard to learn a mitos out of a book. Mitos are personal, they're emotional, they have to be seen in real life, in real time. They're very contextual historically, but also contextual in the moment. Not every context is the same. You have to see how people act in that context. It's really important to have role models for that reason. Just as it's important to have... It's not important to have negative role models, but if you do have negative role models, again, in a respectful way, in a non-judgmental way, you never know, but you say, well, that's really not the type of behavior I think is appropriate. I'm going to try to avoid that type of behavior. Not in a way that sabotages that entire person. It's mean that's a mita that I've got to avoid. That mita and that person is not an attractive mita. So it's very important to not to say, I think some people are afraid to enter that field of judging because it will lead to judgmentalism. Judgmentalism is wholesale rejection of people, simplistic reading of people, caricature reading of people, defining people in broad sweeps rather than subtle sweeps. But judging behavior is important because it helps you identify mitos and then grow from mitos. The best way to acquire mitos is to find people that demonstrate that mitos, especially, you know, because also role models, older people, teachers, rabbis, parents, older people. But in real time, it's osmotic. In real time, it's contagious. You hang around with enough time with a certain person with that mitos, you'll learn to appreciate that mitos. You'll grow and you'll learn and you'll absorb that mitos. So, Hashem doesn't have to punish people for being angry. And this isn't a punishment. It's just a reality. When people get angry at an empirical level, you lose your focus, say things you're embarrassed to say, physiologically your palms start sweating, your diaphragm starts gyrating, it's hard for you to breathe. Sometimes you get really, not dizzy in terms of vertigo, but you don't see things as clearly. There really are two ways to deal with anger. There's anger management and anger eradication. Anger eradication means you want to try to be someone, but this is something you shouldn't aim for right now because it's really very hard at this age. It's really hard. See, someone just doesn't get angry. It doesn't bother you. Teflon. Things roll off of you. It doesn't get to you. You have a broader perspective. Take things into proportion. It's something to strive for. But when you work on meters, you have to be realistic. You can't all of a sudden assume that you're going to go from 0 to 60 and become a complete... That's the greatest mistake people make with meat acquisition in general is to try to accelerate growth in unrealistic fashion. And certain things you just can't reach when you're 18, 19. You don't give up, but pursuing them is quixotic and it's futile. And you want to pursue the types of traits and growth that's real, that you can make real, measurable, concrete growth. So you'll work at it. The real way to do it is to eliminate pride and ego. It's really a combination of a couple of things. Not to have ego, not to feel entitled, to have perspective. Those are the things that typically make us angry. You find yourself in a state where you feel you deserve something, you didn't get it, someone's responsible for it, that object is important to you. That cocktail creates fury, creates this rage. I deserve something, that which I deserve is important, that person took it from me, I'm angry. If you pull out one of those legs, anger starts to fade. Well, maybe that's so important. Maybe what you thought you really needed is not the most important thing in the world. You know, more important thing in this world or me. So once you start going down that road, it's easier just to eliminate anger and then you're a healthier person. But at the early stages of your life, just try to manage your anger. Just because you'll just embarrass. It's not even just a moral recommendation. It's just wise. Think of the last time you acted in a fit of anger. You probably were embarrassed by the way you behaved. It's more likely if there are 25 guys in the room, I'd say probably 20 of you fell on your face. You said something you wish you hadn't. You said it in a manner you wish you hadn't. You did so. You may have had that emotional equilibrium and acted problem. More often than not. That's why it just pays to wait it out. It's like a wave of insanity. You have to wait out the wave and it's really good at the early stages of your moral development just to train yourself. And you're going to have to train yourself by fire. There's no one that can't. Certainly with anger, you have to fall on your face 10 times until you get it. Just train yourself and say there are very few responses that require immediate retaliation. Whatever is angry, let's say it's really important. I mean, if nuclear war is about to erupt, I won't wait it out. I'd probably respond immediately. If a friend of yours, Chas Shalom, is choking and needs CPR, most things in life, the difference between responding in the immediate sense and responding a bit later, nearly marginal. Most complex, the world's not going anywhere, people aren't going anywhere, issues aren't going anywhere. In most cases, it's your anger that convinces you or persuades you. Part of anger's allure is to persuade you it has to be done right now. It's like the secret undercurrent of anger. You're angry, but you got to act right now. If you just eliminate that suffix and that safe and say, well, I'm angry, but I'll wait till tomorrow. I promise you, you'll find that whatever actions, measures, responses are still available, but now you just got more shells in your casing. You've got more tools to deal with. You're thinking more clearly. You can issue a measured response. Now, like I said, it's really hard to train yourself that way because part of the secret whisper of anger is right now. It's going to be done right now. Don't let it wait. So I hope that over the next couple of years, after you fall on your face a few good dozen times, it'll sink in. I'll just prepare you. It's really hard to avoid the face falling, but at least you'll be able to register afterwards. All right, that's the Rabbi Tarek we're talking about. That's exactly what he's talking about. And it happened again. Look, it happened again. At a certain point, you'll condition yourself. I just got to hold myself, handcuff myself, put a golf ball in my mouth, and lock myself in a closet for about 24 hours, and then I'll come out and respond to it. And you know what? Nothing's really has changed. So it's not really a punishment that Moshe begets the halachos. It's also just, you can't be angry and be on your game. You can't be angry. And especially when it comes to Torah. I imagine that if Newton got angry, he'd probably forget some of the laws of physics he discovered. There's a lot of bodies and laws to understand. Anger is invading his mind, his mental waves aren't operating properly because they've been overcome by anger. But maintaining knowledge of Torah isn't just mental acumen. It's a sense that this is Devar Hashem. What if Hashem came to you tonight in a dream? To you. I don't mean to the Jewish people. I mean to you. You were dreaming, and it was clear as day, shining lights, clouds, singing angel. It was pretty clear as a Kodesh Baruch Hu. No mistake. There are no sharks or trains in this movie. In this dream. It's pretty clear it's a nevuah. And he issues 4 lines to you, or he issues 30 lines to you, and you get up the next, and let's say you remembered it the next morning, you'd get up, grab a pen, write it down, store it in the cloud, carry it in your pocket, and pretty much recite that phrase until you memorized it your whole life. Because this is God speaking to you. Like, what do you mean? What would be more important than God speaking to me? It's more important than any other information I'll ever acquire. Well, God spoke to me when he told me. Because memory is not just mental or biological. Memory is psychological, attitudinal. You remember information that's important to you. Anyone here forget their birthday? Okay. Most people don't. Anyone here forget the score last time your team won the championship? Team never won the championship. It's embarrassing anyone there, but some of your team would win the championship. Can you remember the Tosfos you learned that day? Same bits of information 6 months ago, let's say. In fact, this year, I forget whom. I was talking about this in one of the schools I just visited. They asked me to give a little pep talk or something. And then one of the boys actually sat down for an interview with me. And he said, remember you told us that we probably remember the championship score, but we forget the Torah we learned that. I want you to know, I remember the Tosfos I learned the day my team won the championship. Like, I gave him a big check. Didn't accept him. Different story. You know. He still greased the wheels a little bit. But okay, he got a big check. The checks are also good. Not in the middle. Anyway. So why do you remember the score? Not because you deem that important. Because it sinks into your emotion. We decide. I've added, there's sheets around, but maybe just share with someone. We decide. Anyone know where the extra sheets are? No? Here, Avishai has. We decide what to remember. I remember in this room, Rav Lichtenstein, I think we need a couple more, Avishai. Sheet monitor. We see the sheet monitor. I think Rav Lichtenstein in this room once told us that if we forget, no, I don't think he was talking about forgetting, if we don't understand the Tosfos, that's not a mental limitation. That's a moral flaw. What if you knew that you were stricken with a life-threatening disease and no one had an antidote for it, and your life depended upon you discovering some new healing, cure? I don't know, mostly pretty smart, resourceful. He'd probably find some way to piece it together, cobble it together, travel to some far-off African Sahara and find the poison from the fangs of a snake and combine it. You'd certainly try hard. We just don't see Torah as Devar Hashem. It's just not, doesn't register enough. The words that you've studied today is Hashem coming to you in a dream and talking to you. These are the words Hashem told Moshe and Har Sinai, and he told Yeshua, and Yeshua told Shmuel, and Shmuel, and these are words passed down. So every word of Torah you learn is gold. So Moshe Rabbeinu's ability to keep all of Torah in his mind, not just because Moshe had a huge mind, sure he did, but Moshe saw Torah as Devar Hashem, and it's such a love for Hashem and his words, and all he thought about minute by minute was, there's nothing that I want to let my mind consider other than Hashem. What happens when you get angry? Well, that suffers. The person gets angry, inevitably, Hashem has to leave. There's no way for you to be angry if Hashem's in the room. Next time you're angry, you know a good way to shut down your anger? I mean, it's artificial, so it's not going to last long term, but it's just a good trick. Imagine, fill in the blank, we're standing right there. Someone you really, really, really admire, aside from me. Someone you really, really, like, oh my goodness, the biggest Rosh Hashiva you can wrap your, if you're in the room right now with a person, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, when there's no way I would start tirading and rampaging and raging. No way. I would say, I'd be so humble. I'd be so quiet. I'd be so, no way I could get angry. Word Hashem's in the room. That's really tznius, guys. Tznius is not about women's hemlines. Tznius is about Hashem always being in the room. And you act accordingly. And it's for men, and it's for women. Now, the female body is shaped in a certain way that's more attractive than the male body. Therefore, for women, part of the recognition of Hashem's in the room is they don't grandstand by displaying their body. But males also can't grandstand beyond normal, acceptable, whatever those may be, because Hashem's in the room. And part of that is anger. Hashem's always in the room. So when Moshe got angry, Hashem had to leave the room, because no one can get angry. And once Hashem leaves the room, Moshe's Torah begins to fail a little bit. It's not a punishment. It's just a reality, because he can't maintain that mental grasp. He can't clutch as much Torah as he wanted to unless his mind is fully immersed in that hole on Hashem. So Moshe forgets halachos. It happens three other times. This matter is what we see happens. It happens here. It happens in Parshas Pinchas Matos, where he's angered by the returning armies for not attending to the female Midianites, and he forgets the laws of cleaning out the Kalim. And of course, the Mekoshesh and Parshas Shlach. So, first of all, Moshe's not getting angry. He's not screaming and acting like a fool. He's just at Moshe's level. This isn't a punishment. This is a reality. It's a reality in naturalist terms, because when you're angry, you're just not at your... Think about the last time you're angry. Again, it's that your lives aren't that complicated yet. But boy, do they become complicated pretty quickly. And sometimes you've got to navigate some pretty, pretty difficult stretches. And the best bracha for navigating these stretches is have that emotional calm. Because once you're irritated, and once there's turbulence and tumult, you're spinning around. And the world keeps spinning, and you're spinning with it. Just keep your calm. Think about what you'd like to do. Sometimes you make the right call. Sometimes you don't know what the right call is. I mean, you know what the right call is, you can't. But at least you can survey it. So this is how I should be responding. You don't always get it right. At least you can start, rather than being spun around by all the forces and all the thrusts and winds. So at a natural level, you don't always be angry and rage. Some people don't like angry people. It's just not, it's very put off. You don't like to be around people that are always angry. What a good way to create safe places and comfort, a lot of anger in today's world. You can be passionate, you have conviction, you can believe deeply in your ideas, but this anger, this hatred, this really very, it's like one of the top, like I said, 3, 4, try that. You've got it. Work very hard at it. Try not to associate with people of anger, express their flash, their anger physically or vocally or verbally. It's really like, trust me, you got to charge your psychologist the race for this. You'll have a very, very happy life. Very, very successful and satisfying life. You're able to get past that all. When you're looking for a, when you're looking for a spouse, look at that. Someone gets angry very easily. Anger is not a, not a healthy part of being a human being. So much is angry. Iron responds. He explains to you more or less the drill that I provided before. Three karbanos, this is the Gemara's Bachem, three karbanos, two of them were unique karbanos for the day, so you're right, and we indeed ate them, even though we were owning, we were avels, but this karban is just a regular average Rosh Chodesh karban and avel and onen is also, so it's why you burned it. What's Moshe's response? Another great character trait. Two most important phrases to use in life. They're relatives of each other, they're cousins, but you got to learn how to say both. They're each three words. Shouldn't be that hard. They're not Shakespeare. You don't have to recite a sonnet. They're three words, but they're two really important phrases to train yourself to say. To say, there's nothing wrong with saying them. Moshe says both of them. He says, "Oh, I don't know," or "I did know." Rav Amital told us that, and he told us that in the name of Rav Shach, because Rav Amital used to teach with Rav Shach in a yeshiva in Rehovot. He said, Rav Shach told her the most important answer you can give your Talmid, I don't know. On so many levels. Personal, because, oh my goodness, if every single Rebbe you've met knows every single part of Torah, it could be a little bit frustrating, a little bit devastating. I don't know much. But what if I know my Rebbe doesn't know that much either, or at least has limits to his knowledge? We're all in the same boat. Anyone have a frustrating day today loading Pesachim? I did. Okay, so whatever ridge frustrated you, maybe a different ridge frustrated me, but we're walking away with the same frustration. You can't walk out of the base matters. So what are you looking for? Convenience, satisfaction, or challenge? See, part of it is we've created a culture of convenience. Used to be, if you wanted to lose weight, you lost weight. You worked, you schwitzed. You struggled, you limited your food intake, you went to the gym, you lifted weights, you ran. Today, pop a pill. Today, get a little surgery, constrict your stomach. Our world moves so fast, liposuction, we're just looking to do it fast. Food, we don't want to wait for food at a restaurant even. It used to be something called fast food. Today, you die if you don't have fast. I mean, the restaurants can't allow more than a 10-minute. I'm telling you, I used to go to restaurants a little bit older than you. Let's go to restaurants. It was an experience, and you waited, and you... Even the non-fast food restaurants today. There's a more than a 10-minute window, which you're ordering when the food arrives. You're not going to be made in business. Things are just moving too fast. And walk into a drugstore, convenience store today, and see how many products there are for male hygiene and male. You don't really need most of them. You know, body's a pretty simple thing. You don't need that much. Comb, half a toothbrush, maybe a little bit of soap. Maybe. It's a little bar, guys. It's white. You can rub it. I'll explain to you later what soap is. Yeah. A little shampoo, a little dab here, a little dab there. Not a real big deal. But it's created a cultural expectation. Things have to happen. It's why art school is so popular. Rav Hashem is so popular. But art school essentially has leveled all the valleys and all the mountains. It used to be there were mountains and valleys. Yavamos was a mountain. I'm never getting past Yavamos. Chagiga. It's a little lake. It's a little valley. It's a nice little teal. Erevin. Whoa, who can even imagine climbing that one? Okay, Megillah. For high school kids. Megillah. Kiddushin, Chav Chayas, Kol Mitzvos HaBen Olah. What did Kedushin ever do wrong to deserve this at every single high school has to study Chabad? Call Mrs. Avella. I'm like, ask the guy what he's learning. I'll call him. Oh, no, shoot me now. Okay, you're in. Sit at another for hire and call Mrs. Ben Halah. Talk about water torture. Death by a thousand daggers. Kill me now. Now art school is all the same. Yavamas, Megillah, Erevin, it's all the same. It's great that it is, because it provides access. But these cultural attitudes worm their way in and start to displace other valuable expectations and values, and it can become very, very confusing. So, I forgot what we were talking about, but we were talking about, I don't know. The ability for a rabbi to say, I don't know. There's one of the al-chaits, I forget which one it is, al-chait shechatanu fanecha ba'a. Haras, something or other. Always think about this, like, did you sufficiently admit the limitations on your Torah knowledge, or you issued Torah knowledge just to protect your ego when you didn't know, rather than, oh yeah, I know that. It's always easy to make believe you know something, especially if you know a lot more than someone else. You just say, I don't know, that's something I've ever... Remember, Rav Amital was once giving a shir klali on Esrog. And the shir was about the different colorations of Esrog, yellow and green. There, I'm a wise guy. I'm sitting in the front row, and I wanted to impress everyone to ask the question. So tell me, can the yardstick that helps you measure yellows and different hues of yellows and greens, can you extrapolate them from Tzaras? Because in Tzaras, you also have the color spectrum of yellow and greens. If it's yellow, it's tame. If it's green, it's not. So maybe you can equate Tzaras and Esther. I feel pretty good about myself. Right? I'll say, Tzaras? I don't know Tzaras. Go ask this rabbi. He knows Tzaras. Well, he's just... It was just so natural for Rami Bell just to... And that was a lesson to me. Until someone that you look up to teaches you to say, I don't know, it's really hard to say it because you feel like you have to protect your ego and protect your image and your profile. Once that person said, I don't know, so... Not a big deal. Second part is even harder. Second part is, not I don't know, but I'm sorry. They don't always come together. Sometimes... You just say, I'm sorry, because you don't know something, because you acted incorrectly, hurt someone's feeling, made a mistake. The most important discrimination in your vocabulary is between a mistake and a crime. A mistake isn't a crime. They don't sound the same. Probably share the same letters. A crime is a crime, whether it's a legal crime, you stole, battery, kidnapping, whatever. Or just, you did something wrong morally. You did an avera, you did something nasty to someone, and that's a crime. But you also make mistakes. And real leadership is just, it's not just taking responsibility and owning your mistakes, sometimes even owning mistakes for other people. That's real leadership. But let's not talk about that in collective situations, just on a personal level. Make a mistake for saying make a mistake. There's no shame. There's nothing disgraceful about it. To be a human being is to make a mistake. You'll make mistakes literally every day of your life. Every day of your life you're making mistakes. And the portal to improvement is admitting mistakes. Until you admit mistakes, there's no capacity for improvement. You don't even have the threshold. The threshold for improvement begins with, I made a mistake. How do I rectify it? I don't know how this came up, but I was discussing pedagogy and training yourself to be a teacher with someone a couple months ago. I think someone had asked me advice. I have distinct memories of my first 5-6 years of teaching. And every shiur that I gave, I walked out and asked myself, how could I have done that better? Where did I fail in this shiur? How could I give it a better shiur? These are great moments for me. I was disorganized. I presented it improper. It wasn't clear enough. I was tired. I wasn't loaded with information. And you're working. You're, these things become natural to you. And not, obviously, not just in pedagogy, but in anything, in relationships, in the avodas Hashem, habits, and behavioral cycles. So Moshe doesn't just say, Vayita Be'inav, source number Aleph Pasachaf. But he says, the Gemara says, Nizvachim, Vayishma Moshe, Vayitav Be'inav, source number three, look at this, Hodeh V'lobosh. Moshe acknowledges, you're right, I made a mistake, I forgot the halacha. And I'm embarrassed to say, and you know what, Moshe didn't try to cover up, there's no cover up here. By the way, I was away that day when Hashem was teaching me. That's what, he didn't try. Hodeh V'lobosh Lomar, Lo Shamati. Well, I didn't hear that. Thanks for informing me, which would have been still pretty impressive for Moshe to confess. But he says, Shamati, you're right. I heard that halacha. Shachafti, it's too bad. That was good. You're a human being, you want to forget things. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, I forgot it. And of course, in this case, he forgot it. It was a big anger, but it's even more mortifying. Maybe be more defensive and more private about it. And even more impressive is Moshe's next move. No, he's going to say, I don't know, and I forgot it, and I'm sorry. Source number four, Vayishma Moshe, Vayita Be'enav, Hotzi, Cruz, L'chol HaMachin. He sends out an Instagram. What did you say, Yeshua? What did you call it, an Insta-snap? send out an Insta-snap to all of Am Yisrael. Hoda v'lobosh hotzi kruz l'chol ha'machne v'yomer ani ta'isi. Made a mistake. What if people use that phrase today? You have to be careful with these phrases. It becomes so cliche that they block me. I know it's well-intentioned. My bad. It becomes so cliched that it loses any meaning. Got to be careful to speak, avoid cliches. Two types of words you should avoid in life to make really good communication is dead words. This is not a religious guidance. This is just be a better speaker. Four-letter words you never use. Like. It kills me to listen to some people speaking. Like. Just stop it. You see, you're killing me here. Does it add? Just detracts. It just deadens and weights down the sentence. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't finish your sentence. It doesn't add anything. If you want to extend the list, extend it. If you want to truncate the list, truncate it. Don't just throw in an ambiguous, et cetera, et cetera. Don't use the word like. Don't use the word kinda. Trust me. Work hard. Eliminate these verbal tics now. You will be so grateful to me when you get your promotion in 5 years because you're the only guy in the room that knows how to speak like a human being, not like a guru. Boss will say, which one speak that way? I'm going to rip you up. Whatever. You're hired. Just be clear, powerful, succinctly. Second thing, what is it saying? What else? I'm a little tired tonight. What was it saying? What else should you not speak about?
Cliches.
Cliche. I guess I should remember more cliches. Try to root them out. A lot of times it's just become so preponderant. So, any South Africans here? Okay. So, what do you say when someone does something for you? Pleasure. Tell me something. Just tell me what you... Don't just... Okay, it could be like a thank you. So thank you is not cliche. That's just common courtesy. But talk to me. Say, talk to me with you, with your real meaning. Don't just hide behind it. Say it. What do you want to say? What's on your mind? Don't just run around throwing cliches at people. You become fake and artificial. You be real. People want real people, authentic people. Just throw around, hide behind words. So Moshe sends out a missive to the entire machan and says, I was wrong. It got it wrong. I was angry. He's just not embarrassed. Remember a couple months ago, MTA guys weren't here yet. Remember a couple months ago, we had this seminar on psychological well-being and the first speaker was Rabbi Maybrook and he spoke about self-esteem and he provided a workman's definition of self-esteem. You're proud of yourself and you're comfortable with yourself and you don't need other people's gratification or validation, not that you're put offish and standoffish and smug, but for your emotional well-being, you don't need people to think kindly of you. Because once you need that, it can become addictive. And once it's addictive, you're vulnerable to abusive people engineering and manipulating you and exploiting you because you need them. And you're happy with yourself, your family, things that, people that are safe, and you have to defend yourself against. So Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't. So I made a mistake, and here I am. Just a unit. I made a mistake. It's more important for Aaron's dignity to be restored than what people think about me. That's not the important part right now. A really interesting given day. Now, let's look at Aaron a little bit. We spoke a lot about Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's think a little bit about Aaron. What's Aaron going through? Remember, a lot of emotions welling up in this man's heart. Can't imagine a bigger tragedy, losing two of your children on the day. I mean, his mind must be flooded. And why? Such a severe punishment. They weren't killing anyone. They weren't worshiping idols. No matter what their sin was, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, because I'll try to trace their sin. No matter what their sin was, it was slight. They're a little inebriated. They didn't follow protocols by asking Moshe. They're a little bit disrespectful to Moshe and Aaron, we'll see later. They brought a special carbon, okay. Jail sentence. Double life sentence. Incineration, a little harsh. So Moshe responds to Aaron and says, well, that's what it is when you're living so close to Hashem. And I'll say something really harsh, guys. I want you to listen really carefully, because this is essentially what Moshe tells Aaron. So you get to decide to sideline yourself. If you want to live near the fire, and you want to live near the Beis HaMikdash, then you may get burned by the fire. And the fire doesn't come down to incinerate Aaron's children. The fire comes down. The fire comes down to occupy the Mizbech. Don't get too close to the fire. If you misstep, of course, that fire may incinerate you. This is the Esav question. Remember, Parshas told us, let's go back to Parshas told us, Esav says, this Bechara, this Kun is going to kill me. If I'm on the sideline, I don't have so many rules. I'm on a Kohen, can't be Tame, can't be an Onen, I'm to base the wrong way, I don't want it. So you pick your choice, guys. You can just sideline yourself in life and not to deal with it. But then you're living on the sideline, you're spending your life on the bench. Or you're going to be on the field and it's the same thing about being in Eretz Yisrael. Being in Eretz Yisrael means, when I wanted to get all panicky, I'm saying this harshly, it's like basically you're willing to live with the bullseye. You want to be here. You want to be a part of history. You want to shape the future. You want to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You want to be close to the base. I'm not trying to create it in morbid terms and sensationalist terms. I'm just trying to phrase it for you. And Moshe is telling Aaron something similar. These are great tzaddikim. They decided they wanted to be close to the Shekhinah, and we all knew, this is a message to read in a moment, that this building would be sanctified with one of our children. We all knew. It was clear. In order to demonstrate to Am Yisrael how delicate life in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, it was bound to happen. And it was going to happen with surpassing people. Bekravai Akadesh. This is what Hashem told us before. Let's eavesdrop on Moshe tells Aaron. So it's number base, part one. I'm emotionally Aaron, line number four. Achi, b'sinai nemrali sheni asa the kaddish as a bayis is that. I was told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu that at some point this house has to be sanctified and hallowed at some level. There was wondering, line number five, shema obi or becha, me or you, who's... Now we know it's not me, it's not you. Your two children are even greater tzaddikim. Maybe if you and I had sinned, we wouldn't have been treated so severely. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats those that are close to him because the tenor of the relationship is different. Think about who hurts you in life. I don't hurt you because your brother, your sister, your mother, people are really close to you because you have something special. And you open your heart to them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, once you're close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the parameters of the relationship are different. Terms are different. And then two words. I think these are the two most powerful words in the Torah. They have the greatest moral courage. Vayidom Aharon. Aaron's quiet. Doesn't respond. Doesn't give any explanation. Doesn't try to justify or pursue or rail or question or... Your tongue is who you are as a person. Last I checked, animals have eyes. Some have big eyes, some have small eyes. Animals have ears, some have bigger ears, some have small ears, depending upon their needs, hunting needs. You go through your various body parts, more or less. More or less, every single body part is replicated. And probably disposable things, sendable thumbs. Maybe. But what do you possess that no other animal possesses? A tongue capable of cognitive speech. Some animals have tongues. Giraffes have long tongues. In order to grab branches and leaves. Some animals communicate. Most of them without their tongues. Some are chemical communication. Some actually chirp with their tongues. But they don't have the exquisite tongues capable of articulating complex languages that we can, so they have cognitive ideas that we share with each other. So you want to be a better human being, think a lot about how you use your tongue. It's called Shmiras HaLashon. It's the most powerful part of your body, not in your brain. But with your brain, it's just a quantitative difference, brain size and brain. So with the tongue, it's an exponential difference, a different caliber, a different category. And a lot of it we've spoken about before, and maybe I'll speak about later as the year progresses, especially during the summer when some of the Americans leave. I'll try to recoup or review some of the ideas that we talked about early in the year. But one of the ways you think about using your tongue is not just curse words and not just cynicism. One of the ways you want to train your tongue is probably the greatest gift of your tongue, which is ironic, is the ability not to use your tongue. The ability to just be silent. The ability to know when not to speak. To hold your tongue. Literally. Hold your tongue in place. And sometimes it's at these dramatic moments, such as our own, where he's bursting with frustration and anger and disappointment and confusion and so on. Where you're being stressed to use your tongue and you withhold all that temptation. And some of it is just the daily intercourse of human affairs, when to be quiet, when not to. As a general, excuse the mixed pun, general rule of thumb, nothing wrong with being quiet. I don't mean quiet like introverted and mean-spirited and making faces. I just mean, let other people do the talking. How many times do you speak just to fill the empty space that you feel awkward in, and you're just trying to fill it with speech? How much of your speech is deliberate, necessary, and vital, and productive, and agenda? How much is just filler? That's a good yardstick to start to think about using in time. I just fill empty space with noise? Or is it really productive, and is it really contributing anything? It could be Torah, it could be friendship, it could be kindness, or whatever. Is there a purpose to it? When's the last time you just felt awkward being silent to fill that silence with? Try to check yourselves in those moments and learn to just, well, you don't have to speak. Sometimes, even when you're with people and you want to be with people, a person comes to a house of an avel, very awkward moment, especially you'll start to learn, so you're going to ask an avel. Sometimes you're going to ask an avel. I've spoken to avel, who've told me after the shiva, boy, some people said some really silly things. I understand that because people are uncomfortable, you don't know what to say, and okay, so, better choice, just sit quietly. Just sit quietly. You can convey a lot by just going to a basin level and sitting quietly and just showing the person that you're there. Even if the person doesn't know, just your being there. A great man I once knew told me that, didn't I find out in the story, that he once traveled several hours just to be outside the operating room of a person he felt very close to. He never showed up. The person wasn't really ready to receive him. He told him he wanted that person to feel that he was in the same building, just to be. It wasn't necessary medically, it wasn't providing medical guidance. He was a rabbi, just traveled several, was at an advanced age. Traveled 4 or 5 hours, sat outside the room, and then traveled back. Learn shtika. The Rishim and Gamliel saw a lot of impressive people walking through his father's house in Gamliel, who was Ganassi. Source number 4 in the back. Shimon Omer, Kol Yama Gidalti Beina Chachamim, Gidalti Beina Chachamim. My entire life I spent watching these people walk through my father's house, the palace. Velam Matsasi Guf Tov Elashtika. And really it was about learning how to be quiet. I saw the people of caliber, people of substance. I saw them the ability to be quiet. And again, I mean quiet at two levels. One of the things that amazed me most about Rav Lichtenstein is people, at least in the old days, the ideological trade wars and who was firm, which Russia did, they said so many negative things to bait Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron never responded. Never felt the need to respond. Never would say anything. I'm amazed. And world upon. I love the elections because it's basically it's great entertainment. I'm just amazed that none of these politicians just realize that maybe they just decided not to slander and badmouth the other. Maybe people get a sense of there's dignity here and give, I don't know, maybe the voting intellect of the general public is so low and diminished, but I would vote for that person. I saw assuming the policies more or less stacked up with my interests. A person of dignity. Again, I keep telling you this, there should be no confusion whatsoever. It's really, really important to make this division, especially to the Americans. There's policies, values, and traits. You may agree with Donald Trump's policies. That's politics. There's no place in this room. You may even agree with some of his values, if you feel pro-abortion, anti-abortion, whatever. But traits is a monster. In terms of who he is as a person and those character traits. That's not a political statement. You get that? So when you're not looking at an exposition of moral traits. There's nothing there, nothing healthy. You could say, I'll vote for him again next election because I feel the policies are too important. I feel like at some level he's got values with Democrat, liberals. There's tenable positions. I'm telling you to vote for. But there's just such cacophony. Oh, you hate Trent? What about what he did for Israel? Those aren't important. I'm just highlighting. So some would say, maybe I wouldn't agree. I don't think that our president has to be a role model. I expect your role model should be other people. I expect everyone in this room to be able to find adequate role models outside of the person holding the office and some big white building. It shouldn't mean that much to you, in my opinion, but you can differ from that. You can say, well, maybe not for me, maybe for other people in the United States and across the world. Those are all legitimate positions, but. So learn to, Rabbi Kiva talked about it also, just we'll finish before modern. He was said a little bit different. Kiva Omer, Schok v'kalas rosh magin le'erva, siag l'chach mashtika. Very interesting, different metaphor. Siag is a wall. Siag l'chach mashtika. Why would quiet be a wall to knowledge and wisdom? Well, keep in mind, if you're talking, it's pretty hard to listen. And if you're not listening, you're missing a lot. And if you're missing a lot, it's hard to be a wise person. At the base level, we don't have time to fully unpack this metaphor. The base level, being quiet is great, not just because it shows moral restraint and courage, but also because there's a lot you can learn by observing and listening and and if you're busy with moving your tongue, it's a little hard to really absorb and imbibe information. More or less, those two are mutually exclusive. It's hard to receive and appreciate all the stimulus, everything that's happening when you're the one talking and presenting. That's why it's a siyag l'chachma. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you.